It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Hong Kong student leaders agree to talks with government, and up to 100 may have had contact with Texas Ebola victim. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. China's Communist Party is warning pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong are doomed to fail as the territory's Beijing-friendly chief executive rejected protester demands to resign. A front-page editorial in today's party-run People's Daily repeated Beijing's assertion that the protests are illegal, saying there is no room for concessions on greater democratic reforms. The editorial was published after Chief Executive Lung Chun-ying ignored a midnight deadline to step down instead of proposing talks with a top official on resolving the political crisis. Only about 100 protesters remained early today outside Liang's office, down from the thousands that had gathered ahead of the ultimatum. Federal and Texas state health officials are looking for as many as 100 people who may have had direct or indirect contact with the first Ebola patient diagnosed in the United States. But the head of the Centers for Disease Control, Tom Frieden, says he's confident the spread of the disease can be contained.
The bottom line here is that I have no doubt that we will control this importation or this case of Ebola so that it does not spread widely in this country. It is certainly possible that someone who had contact with this individual, a family member or other individual, could develop Ebola in the coming weeks. But there is no doubt in my mind that we will stop it here.
The virus causes uncontrollable bleeding, vomiting, and diarrhea. This is VOA News. Nigeria's military is standing by its assertion that the self-proclaimed leader of militant group Boko Haram is dead. The military's comments Thursday came after the insurgents released a new video that shows the purported Abubakar Shiku asserting he is alive and that his group is running an Islamic caliphate and territorial controls. In a statement, the Nigerian Defense Headquarters insisted the man in the video was killed last month during a battle in the town of Kandunga. Turkish lawmakers have authorized military force in Syria and Iraq, a vote that could allow the country to battle Islamic State militants nearing Turkey's border. The law also allows foreign forces to operate from Turkey against the IS. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel.
Regarding the Turkish Parliament's vote today, we view that as a very positive development. We appreciate the Parliament's overwhelming vote. We will continue to consult with the Turkish government.
The United States is leading a coalition of countries to counter the group's expansion, and the U.S. envoy for the Anti-Islamic State Coalition is expected to travel to Turkey on a trip to the region that began Thursday in Iraq. The United States has partially lifted a decades-long ban on lethal weapon sales to Vietnam, a historic move that comes nearly four decades after the end of the Vietnam War. The U.S. State Department spokeswoman, Jen Psaki.
The secretary informed Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Min that the State Department has taken steps to allow for the future transfer of maritime security-related defense articles to Vietnam. This policy supports Vietnam's efforts to improve its maritime domain awareness and maritime security capabilities.
Vietnam is facing increasingly aggressive Chinese territorial claims to large swaths of the South China Sea and its mineral and energy treasure. Vietnamese maritime patrols have faced off against Chinese naval forces on several occasions as tensions have risen in recent years. U.S. Senator John McCain, a former Navy pilot and prisoner of war in Vietnam, welcomed the deal, but Reuters news agency quotes him as calling for improvements in the Hanoi government's human rights record. Shelling in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk on Thursday killed a Swiss employee of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Western journalists in Donetsk and Russian news agencies reported that a building housing the local office of the ICRC in the center of the rebel-controlled city was hit during the shelling. The ICRC confirmed that a Swiss colleague had been killed in the barrage. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, and this is VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batte, Washington. Today is Friday, the third day of October, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Liberian man diagnosed with Ebola in the United States might have lied on his airport health questionnaire.
If it is determined that he did make a false declaration and he showed this level of depraved indifference, the Liberia Airport Authority will recommend his prosecution upon his return to Liberia.
Binya Kesele is the director of the Liberian Airport Authority. Liberians in Dallas, Texas, confront Ebola at home and in the United States. Britain called for international help to combat Ebola. And Lesotho's rival political parties agree to hold early elections.
National general elections will be held towards the end of February 2015 and on a date that will be determined by His Majesty.
Cyril Ramaphosa is South Africa's deputy president and SADC lead negotiator on Lesotho. Meanwhile, the Basotho people say they cannot wait to end insecurity and tension in their country. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's post, and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian authorities say they wish Liberian U.S. Ebola patient Thomas Eric Duncan a speedy recovery and hope that there will be no further infections with those he might have come in contact with. But the director of the Liberian Airport Authority says if it is determined that Mr. Duncan lied on his airport health questionnaire, he would be prosecuted upon his return to Liberia. Binya Kesele says everyone who comes in and out of Liberia's airports goes through Ebola screening using forms prepared with the assistance of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
Everybody who leaves our airports, they go through screening. From the morning of July 26th, Saturday, up until now and continuing into the future, we have put stringent measures in place to screen, monitor every individual who comes through our airports, whether you're leaving the country or entering. In fact, every 48 hours, we review our procedures. We have actually worked with and continue to work with experts from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They've helped us with some of our procedures at the airport and have endorsed the procedures that we have in place. From July 26th to now, we screen nearly 10,000 people leaving our airports, commercial passengers. Your temperature is checked 3 times before you enter the gate to enter the airport property, and then before you enter the terminal building, because then there's a queuing point there where there's a delay, and then before you board the aircraft. So, you know, we do all that is humanly possible to screen and ensure that people who have elevated temperatures don't leave our airports.
If Mr. Duncan came through the airport, and given the serious nature of this Ebola, is there a particular questionnaire that they have to complete?
For outbound passengers, we do have, as I said, we have a primary screening and a secondary screening. Primary screening form, Mr. Duncan and other passengers filled. Mr. Duncan filled one out. All passengers filled them up. If my memory serves me right, the specific number up to press time is around 9,620-something patients that we've screened since July 26th. We have all of their records, and all the folks go through this primary screening. Mr. Duncan's primary screening form, we have a copy of it. We've shared that with the Centers for Disease Control, with our Ministry of Health, and with our Ministry of Justice. If his temperature had been elevated, we would have sent him to secondary screening. If he had answered yes to any of the questions on that form, we would have sent him to secondary screening. So these forms are not just done by the airport. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control has actually worked directly, and they are still today, as we speak, working on revisions to the form.
Listening to you, Mr. Kesele, it seems that Mr. Duncan was screened. Could it be that he did not answer the questions correctly or honestly? And what is it that the Liberian government will do in case he did not answer honestly?
Firstly, let me be clear. We do wish him a speedy recovery, and all of those who have had contact, we hope that there are no further infections. You know, our prayers are definitely with all. That being said, if it is determined that he did make a false declaration and he showed this level of depraved indifference, the Liberia Airport Authority will recommend his prosecution upon his return to Liberia. This is a clear warning that we're sending to all who choose to travel through our airports. A large portion of what we can do through screening relies on people doing the honorable and the right thing. James, if you were traveling out of Liberia, and the expectation, we would screen your temperature But when we ask you specific questions, or we ask you, you have a questionnaire that you fill in, you're supposed to fill in those things honestly.
Binya Kesele is director of the Liberian Airport Authority. He spoke with me from the capital, Monrovia. The first case of Ebola in the United States was diagnosed this week in Dallas, Texas. And the infected person is a man from Liberia who spent a few days with family members before being admitted to a hospital and put in isolation. The fear that he may have infected others is especially strong in the area's Liberian community, which, as viewers Greg Flick has reported from Dallas, is already struggling to help families devastated by the disease back in Africa.
News that a Liberian in Dallas had become the first person in the U.S. to be diagnosed with Ebola pained local Liberians like African food store owner Stephen Joe.
A lot of people are kind of quiet, you know, because more likely it's kind of embarrassing because we don't expect this to be going like this, you know. So it's kind of embarrassing to the Liberian community as a whole.
Joe says a lack of good sanitation and health infrastructure has fostered the spread of Ebola back in Liberia. Now that it's arrived here, he advises great caution.
Don't try to shake other people's hands, you know, just the African way. Most of the time you see people, you greet and shake their hand, try to avoid that.
Health officials say Ebola is transmitted only by people who display symptoms, but many people here fear the deadly virus after having lost family members to it in Liberia. Relieving their grief over such loss is a challenge for the Reverend Nathan Cortu, who ministers to a large Liberian congregation in Euless near Fort Worth.
Every Sunday we come here, people are crying. We get heard the news somebody lost their family back home.
The congregation has been collecting donations of money and medical supplies to help fight Ebola in Africa. But Cortu says now the threat is here.
Honestly, every one of us are worried, including myself. But now we have to deal with this on two fronts. So that's what's making it very difficult for us.
There are 10,000 Liberians scattered across Dallas, Fort Worth, and their many suburbs. But they're linked together by the Liberian Community Association of Dallas-Fort Worth, whose president, Stanley Gay, worries Ebola could become a stigma for Africans.
Not everybody from Liberia or West Africa or from Africa will be infected, so I don't want people to have that stigma about Africans.
The Liberian man being treated for Ebola in a Dallas hospital has been identified as Thomas Eric Duncan. Gay says he does not know him, but he has been able to contact his wife by telephone.
I just was giving her some moral support from the community, letting her know that we are out there praying for she and her family.
That's also the theme Reverend Cortu emphasizes for the whole community and their loved ones back in Liberia.
Liberia, we are resilient people. We go through this. We are going through war. This is yet another situation that will come in our country that we trust in God we'll be able to have a victory over it.
Officials from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have conferred with members of the Liberian community here to help educate family members back in Liberia on the best ways to avoid contracting the disease and spreading it to others. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Dallas.
The international community met Thursday in London to discuss new ways to overcome West Africa's Ebola crisis at a conference. As Sela Henderson reports for VOA, British officials and aid groups are urging that countries and donors follow through on their pledges to combat the often lethal disease.
Britain's Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond was at the conference in London.
Well, we're at a tipping point in the management of this Ebola outbreak. We've got more than 20 countries coming together here, and we're hoping that the commitments and the pledges that are made today will allow us to make a step change in our response, get ahead of the curve so that we can contain and then beat this disease.
According to the World Health Organization, more than 3,300 people have died from Ebola in West Africa, with the vast majority of cases in Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia. Hammond asked countries to increase financial aid and resources to resolve the crisis on the ground, including sending medical staff, equipment, and transportation. Justin Forsyth, chief executive of the British charity Save the Children, said nurses are a major priority.
We need to get nurses in. In these countries, there's only 1,000 nurses before this crisis in Sierra Leone, a country of 6 million people, and even less than that in Liberia. So we need to act now, and the people are the critical part of this, as well as the money.
Forsyth said last week that five people were infected in Sierra Leone every hour. He said that rate could rise to 10 an hour by the end of the month. Britain is the top international donor to Sierra Leone and has taken the lead on trying to combat the crisis there. It has pledged $200 million and has also provided nearly 150 new treatment beds and promised around 600 more in the coming months. The country's National Health Service, or NHS, has asked its workers to volunteer to travel to Sierra Leone, and more than 160 staff have volunteered to work at a British-funded treatment centre in Freetown, Sierra Leone's capital. But aid groups say more needs to be done. In a critical report published on Monday, British politicians said international aid cuts to Sierra Leone and Liberia have compromised the fight against the virus. Britain's Department for International Development, or DFID, had planned to cut its bilateral budget for the two countries by a fifth between the 2013-14 fiscal year and 2015-16. International Development Committee Chairman Sir Malcolm Bruce told VOA that Britain must stand by its long-term commitments to these countries.
For countries like this that are emerging out of conflict, that are fragile, that are weak, that have very few doctors and nurses, we really have to work with them over years to build up an effective health system so that they can manage both the normal day-to-day disease that they face and also have the resilience to deal with a crisis like this, which clearly has overwhelmed them.
In response, DFID said the report was out of date and reiterated that Britain is the largest donor to Sierra Leone. Selah Hennessy for VOA News, London.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, the 3rd day of October. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. Lesotho's national general elections will be held at the end of February, 2 years earlier than planned. The announcement on Thursday came after government coalition leaders signed an agreement meant to hold them to decisions made earlier at talks to secure lasting peace in the mountainous kingdom. Gillian Parker reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa's Deputy President, Cyril Ramaphosa, was named the regional facilitator to Lesotho last month, as the Southern African Development Community strove to resolve the country's political challenges following an attempted military coup on August 30th. Prime Minister Tom Thabane looked forlorn as Ramaphosa announced that the country's parliament will reconvene on October 17th.
The sitting of the parliament will be limited to passing of a budget and to do all other related matters regarding the holding of early elections. National general elections will be held towards the end of February 2015 and on a date that will be determined by His Majesty. Parliament, having been reconvened, will be dissolved at the beginning of December 2014 to prepare the country for the holding of general elections.
Mr. Thabane presides over a coalition government, the first of its kind in the country's history, but one that was a product of political expediency in 2012, when elections failed to produce a clear winner. Discord within the country's tripart coalition has been building rapidly since Mr. Thabane declared a 10-month suspension of parliament in June. The declaration came after the opposition tried to pass a motion of no confidence that would see the prime minister ejected from power and has been accused of coordinating attacks on police and political rivals. Kamoli, who is reportedly surrounded by a group of armed loyalists, faces accusations of mutiny and treason, but remains at large. Ramaphosa on Thursday carefully dodged questions about who is the current leader of the armed forces. South Africa's deputy premier said that SADC will investigate a shootout between the police and army on Tuesday night and appealed to the security forces to stop fighting.
We want peace, amicable dealings between the army and the police, but more importantly, we would like to see the army and the police being depoliticized. We want armies in the region and on the continent to be depoliticized to serve the interests of the people and not to serve party political interests.
The kingdom in the sky, with a population of 2 million, has suffered a series of coups since independence from Britain in 1966. Long structural issues will have to be addressed in order to break the cycle of political validity that continues to see power disputes during and after elections. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
VOA's Peter Clotty also spoke with Thabo Takalekwale, a spokesman for Lesotho's Prime Minister Thomas Thabane, about the agreement.
This agreement was signed by the 9 political parties registered in the Independent Electoral Commission in Lesotho. Basically, what the agreement says is that Parliament will be reconvened by the head of state, Kindiki III, on 17th October 2014. And the second most important point is that national general elections will be held towards the end of February 2015 on a date to be set by His Majesty the King.
Was the issue of stability and security improvement discussed at this meeting? And because concerns have been raised about the renegade general who some people accuse of being the mastermind of the alleged attempted coup, was this raised at this meeting and how was it handled?
It was raised, but it was decided by the facilitator or the mediator himself that next week he's coming back to Lesotho again, now to tackle the security challenges facing the country. But what I can tell you is that before today's signing of this agreement, Deputy President Ramaphosa had a brief meeting with this renegade general. That meeting was just to pave way for a series of consultations and meetings that he will be holding next week when he comes back to Lesotho, solely to address the security concerns and challenges facing the country.
With this level of agreement unanimously signed by these 3 political parties in the coalition government, some people are suggesting that that could possibly ease political tension in the country. What do you see about this assessment by some political analysts in the kingdom?
I think that the signing of this agreement is a step in the right direction, since we had no alternative. We had exhausted all means of trying to restore law and order, to restore peace and stability in this country. Now, the fact that this agreement was signed unanimously, including opposition parties in the country, shows that there's some light at the end of the tunnel. And we are hoping, like we are saying, that this will bring, will ease the prevailing tension in the country right now.
Thabo Takalekwala is the spokesman for Lesotho's Prime Minister Thomas Thabane. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Maseru. The ongoing conflict in South Sudan is straining relations between the government and international organizations who are trying to assist millions in need. VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports on attempts to rein in the NGOs and the agencies that are pushing the boundaries and testing a government trying to take control of a country in crisis.
In mid-September, South Sudan's labor minister warned all foreign workers in the country to give up their positions by October 15th and open up jobs to locals. The order was interpreted as a kind of mass expulsion of foreigners who, through business interests, international aid agencies, and diplomatic missions, have been propping up the South Sudan government and providing the bulk of basic services in areas like health and education since before the country declared independence in 2011. After a backlash from the international community, the government quickly retracted the order, which Paul Kumbo, South Sudan's Director General for Information, says was misinterpreted in the first place.
Some NGOs have taken it wrongly, and then they've tried to blame the government. They are chasing the foreigners and all this, which is not true.
He said relations with foreign workers and NGOs in particular are strong, but stands by the opinion that more jobs should be opened up to locals. To that end, South Sudan's National Assembly has been considering a so-called NGO bill that would put greater oversight on international organizations, legislation which some observers say could become oppressive. Tensions have increased in the last 10 months as the government fights an armed rebel opposition that has taken control of key areas of the country. Relations hit a low point in March when South Sudanese authorities discovered weapons in a United Nations convoy headed to Unity State, an area with a heavy rebel presence, as well as United Nations peacekeeping force. The UN, which is not authorized to ship weapons by road, later apologized. Neal Tietmammer, a researcher at South Sudan's Sud Institute, says a communication breakdown during incidents like these is partly to blame for the strain in relations.
So in general, the situation was made worse because the working relationship was not transparent. The way the NGOs were operating was not transparent to the government. And the government wanted to be consulted on a number of things, but the NGOs were not in a position to do that.
A major issue of contention is that aid agencies say they need to operate in areas that are under rebel control, conflict zones where displacement is high and humanitarian needs are the most pressing. UN humanitarian coordinator Toby Lanzer says relations with the government at this point are the worst he has seen.
The deeper issue here is how do you maintain a constructive relationship in situations of internal conflict when you need to be working with all authorities.
Since the conflict began 10 months ago, some 10,000 people have been killed and more than 1.5 million have been displaced, many of them taking refuge at UN camps. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Juba.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa's Sports. Here is Mark Awoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. The Rwanda Sports Minister, Joseph Habineza, reiterates that they will no longer have players with dual citizenship in their national football team, the Amavubi. Habineza told the Kigali media on Thursday that dual citizenship among some of their national team players has cost the country. The latest case is that of striker Dadi Birori, who was recently banned from football for 2 years by the Confederation of African Football for having a Rwanda and a Democratic Republic of Congo passports bearing different names and dates of birth. The matter led to Rwanda being disqualified from the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. Meanwhile, hosts Namibia play Algeria in Windhoek as Zambia engage visitors Cameroon in Lusaka in women's friendlies tomorrow, Saturday. These teams are playing their final build-up matches ahead of the Telkom Namibia African Women's Championships due to start in Windhoek, Namibia next week. Turning to athletics, the 2011 IAAF World Athletics Championship long jump bronze medalist Ngondizashe Makusha is the most prominent of four Zimbabwean athletes who have secured Olympic Solidarity Scholarships to enable them to train and compete effectively as they prepare for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Brazil. Sprinter Gabriel Mvumvuri, together with London Olympic marathon runners Kasper Nyasango and Wirimai Juao, are the other beneficiaries of this program. Finally, in cricket, South African Peter Kirstens is the new Uganda national cricket coach. His immediate challenge is to guide the Ugandans during the week-long ICC Division III Cricket League in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, which starts on the 23rd of October. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. Wishing you all a fabulous weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report on Monday. And that's it for this Friday, October 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotin and Ricky Strack, as well as sports editor Mark Oldman, I'm James Button, Washington, also saying, have a good weekend, Africa.
Do you love African music?
Music time in Africa. Wake, 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 wake,
wake. This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000, and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.